Hello and welcome to 7 Minutes, everyone's favorite podcast about video games. This is episode 15. Before we get into what today's topic is going to be, let me introduce myself, and then I will allow others to introduce themselves.
Allow.
Oh, wow.
Quiet over there. This is Zach.
This is Angela.
This is Robert.
Cool. Well done, guys. We traditionally start our podcasts with a review of what we've been playing since the last time we recorded.
Although maybe for this one, aren't we like 2 weeks overdue for a podcast?
Yeah. You know, Zach and I bought a home, and
it involves a fair bit of labor.
Yeah, it did. And so we didn't have a whole lot of time to play games, although in the madness, I did play something other than Final Fantasy XIV and Animal Crossing.
That's true madness.
And Animal Crossing Pocket Camp and Mario Kart Tour. I played Miami Hotline, and I've been wanting to give that game... Hotline Miami. This, thank you. Hotline Miami. And I've been wanting to play that game for a while. Interestingly, it was recommended for people who really liked Ruiner, and I very much liked Ruiner. I can kind of see overall why that would be a recommendation for someone who really liked Ruiner, though it's not... it's definitely not the exact same type of game. You know, it's an kind of top-down twin-stick shooter, although with Ruiner, it was almost an isometric perspective, whereas Hotline Miami is definitely, like, just totally top-down. Ultimately, I didn't end up finishing it because I was just too angry by the end. It's a really, really brutal game. I think it's the most difficult game I've ever played. It's definitely harder than Cuphead, at least to me, because Cuphead had previously been the most difficult game I'd ever played, and it made me really angry. But this game made me just totally furious, and I ended up playing it for 8 hours straight. I didn't even realize I had been playing it that long. And, like, I started playing it sometime in the evening, and by the time I finally got to the final boss and was just like, oh no, this is ridiculous, it was like 5 in the morning. But it was overall really good. It's creepy and kind of disturbing at times. And I think it's really interesting how you'll get phone calls from people who are asking you to basically commit hits, assassinations, but it's always coded. They'll give you an address. But then I noticed that more than once when you show up to the place to commit the hit, the address is different than the address you were told. And so there's a lot of psychological stuff going on. So it's this question of, like, you know, you as the player, are you insane? Are you losing your mind? Is there a reason why you're not at the right address? Are you even killing the right people? It's a really, really interesting game.
Can I ask a question about this?
Of course.
What's up with the chicken head?
Well, there are... So you can find different masks within the game. And the masks give you different abilities. But... there's this point, and I haven't really looked too... I mean, I read the Wikipedia article about the game's story. I don't remember all the details, because it's a pretty involved story, but there are multiple points where you as the player are... you're speaking to 3 different people. And there's someone in, like, a chicken mask, and someone in an owl mask. And I don't remember what the third mask is... Yeah, I don't remember what the third one is. But they each have, like, different personalities, but I think it's supposed to be you talking to yourself. And the 3 different masks are 3 different sides of your own personality.
Okay.
And so the chicken mask, I can't remember. I think that might be the one that's slightly... I mean, they're all antagonistic in their own ways. But, like, the owl... I think the owl is the one that's particularly aggressive... One of the other ones just seems kind of mildly disappointed in you. But it's a very interesting game.
Robert, have you tried Hotline Miami?
I think I played a little bit of the first one on Wii U, but I never beat it.
Yeah, I was playing this on Switch.
Yeah, and, I haven't tried it at all.
Yeah, I bought the two pack that includes the first and the second game, and so I haven't played the second game yet. But it's creepy. You know, there are definitely like different things that you experience that are really unnerving, and the character is rapidly basically losing his mind as the game goes on, and seeing really disturbing things. But yeah, it's a great game. It's just, you know, it was, at least for me, it was a very difficult game.
Cool. I also played a game that is not Final Fantasy XIV. it was a, it's called Murder by Numbers. It's an indie game that was pitched as, and this is why I bought it, a cross between Phoenix Wright and Picross. And hey, I like Picross, and I really liked the first Phoenix Wright game, so it seemed worth a shot. It takes place in the mid-90s. There's a lot of like really obnoxiously loud styles that the characters are wearing. I think at some point I said out loud, why is everyone in this game a clown? it's very like, if you think of like Saved by the Bell, for example, just very loud fashions. You're playing as a, not a detective, but as an actor who plays a detective on TV. And she gets let go from her contract. And then almost immediately after, the producer on the show gets murdered. So she ends up getting like roped into that. Kind of ironic because she just got fired from her job as a fake detective. And the Picross comes in because you have like a little robot buddy, like a flying old CRT monitor, kind of looks like. Mm-hmm. Its visual processor is damaged. And the way the game represents that is he sees something. And then in order to figure out what he's seeing, he has to Picross his way into understanding what it is that he's looking at. So it's kind of a cool way of framing that in the story. The problem with this game is that the Picross is not that good. Like the kind of like UI experience of playing through the Picross puzzles is fine, but the Picross puzzles are a little too easy. Like they're almost all 15 by 15 grids or smaller. I think there's two 15 by 20 grids in the entire game. And the other thing that's really unsatisfying about the Picross puzzles is that they, you know, ideally you do a Picross puzzle, and at the end, when by the time you finish solving it, you know what you're looking at. You can even use that to help you solve the puzzle in some cases, where it's like, oh, I think I'm drawing like a small bird, like a sparrow. You can use what you know about objects in the world to figure out what you're building towards. And in this one, it just looked like a bunch of pixelated gibberish every time.
Yeah, you would show me even the finished image, and it didn't look like anything.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was a very like, I don't know if it was supposed to be very blown up and zoomed in, but they didn't look great.
Have you guys seen that? There's a like a visual joke, meme, whatever you want to call it, that I've seen on the internet. It's called How to Draw an Owl. And it's two panels, and it says, step one, draw two ovals. Step two, draw the rest of the fucking owl. Like, it's obviously, like, sarcastic, not helpful. But, like, the jump between the two ovals to the finished owl is about the jump is between your finished Picross puzzle and an image of what it's supposed to be. So that's the Picross. If you're just looking for, like, if you just like Picross and maybe a little on the easier side, it's decent on that count. But the problem is more actually on the Phoenix Wright side of things, because you have a series of four cases, but for all of them, they're just super linear. You don't really get any of the satisfying leaps of logic that the player has to make. There are leaps of logic that the characters make in the game. It's really more just like a visual novel more generally than Phoenix Wright style games specifically, which would have been fine, but that's not what I was expecting, because I saw people, like, you know, elevator pitching this game shorthand as Picross meets Phoenix Wright, and this is not going to scratch anyone's Phoenix Wright itch. I refuse to believe it. It's not there. I still had a fun enough time with it, because I really do like Picross, and that was enough to carry me through, but...
Okay. So, since the last time we recorded, I've played some stuff, but I've been busy, so I was made a lecturer at the college that I went to, so I'm teaching game design one to a bunch of undergrads and two grad students. So that's been kind of cool. It's ironic because it's board games, it's not video games, but it's been fun it's been fun going through all the mechanics and refamiliarizing myself with some of the academic terminology that gets used for talking about video games, like MDA and all that, mechanics, dynamics, aesthetics. But beyond that, I've also been playing a few things here and there. I played the Great Ace Attorney Chronicles. That was fun. I really loved the period setting. Most of the Phoenix Wright games don't go for like realism of any kind, whether it's the setting or the courtroom proceedings, obviously. This one doesn't go for realistic courtroom proceedings either, but it definitely has a more realistic backdrop. It's the, how do you pronounce it? Meiji?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Meiji.
The Meiji setting. So that's like right as Japan is starting to industrialize and reopen to the outside world. And I actually read a review. I'm not going to say who it was, but the reviewer had the nerve to say that it was alienating having this historic backdrop. I'm like, are you for real right now? They even acknowledge in the review, I mean, they're Japanese developers talking about Japanese history. It's like, yeah, if you can't handle it, go play something else. Like, it was the stupidest criticism I've ever heard.
Well, this is why the Phoenix Wright games take place in Los Angeles, right? And you're eating, quote, hamburgers that are not hamburgers. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's also why, like, in Final Fantasy VIII, instead of being really into meat buns, they say Zell is really into hot dogs.
Or Brock offers Ash and Misty rice balls. Or, sorry, donuts that are really rice balls.
But, there is, like, a segment of the North American audience that does have a hard time relating to, like,
I have no sympathy
overly
for
Japanese
his,
things.
No sympathy for them. Or this reviewer who ostensibly is a professional. But anyway. And then the other game I've been playing lately is Sonic Colors Ultimate. So we got a review key in for that. And I thought it's really well done. My only complaints, because I played the original on Wii using the Pro Controller. I didn't like playing with the Wii Remote. So it feels the same to me in that regard. But they totally effed with the soundtrack. There's a bunch of like remixed versions of some of the songs. And of all the Sonic games outside of like the original ones or Mania, this game had one of my favorite soundtracks of any of the 3D Sonics. It had this just really cool, like there were these little guitar pieces and just like the whole thing was just this really enjoyable soundtrack. And then they went and changed part of it. And so it really disrupted some of my enjoyment because there's certain levels where I'm used to the music sounding a certain way. And instead, it's like this lesser version. And man, I wish there was a way to go back to like the default soundtrack. But other than that, it's a good remake of it or remaster or whatever. And then the last thing I've been playing, I'm going to say the name correctly. I pulled it up on my phone because I can never remember the number order. It's the Silver Case 2425. So it's one, I don't know if it's the first game made by Suda51 or like one of the first games, but it's a visual novel, ironically, since we're talking about Phoenix Wright. It's quirky so far. I think this came out in July, maybe, June or July. And I just finally got a copy. And I was sitting last night and starting it up. And man, it's total Suda51, just with this sort of disjointed feeling, narrative and world and all that. But so far, it's been enjoyable. Next time we record, I'll have a better opinion on it. But that has been me.
Cool. So, episode 15, what we're talking about this time is characters in games. And not really kind of a broad overview of characters in games in general. We're talking about some of our favorites. Heroes, favorite villains, favorite... Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of characters that go into a game beyond the good guy and the bad guy. So... Yeah, we're just going to be going around naming characters we like and kind of explaining why we like them, talking about them. Robert, want to kick us off?
Oh, okay. I have trouble with this because I love the Mario games, I love the Zelda games, but I think in terms of like favorite characters, it's neither of them. I mean, I love both and we'll probably mention both during this, but...
Despite the history of this podcast, there is no obligation to name Nintendo characters for every topic prompt.
Anyway. Well, I'm going to stick with what I was going to say, because there are non-Nintendo characters I love, too. But I think my favorite character is probably Samus from Metroid. I've always just thought Samus was super cool. And we talked about this, I think, in the last podcast we recorded. But one of the most enjoyable aspects about Samus to me is that she's a woman character. But, like, the emphasis is never really on the fact that she's a woman. And so it's cool because to me it's like the way she's portrayed, it's as though, I'm going to phrase this poorly, but hopefully I can explain it. She's portrayed as though she were a male character. Because a male character there's no focus on the fact that they're male. You know, it's not like, well, you know, you have Solid Snake and we're going to emphasize his maleness in some way, you know, and instead, with Samus, it's just like they tell you she's the galaxy's greatest bounty hunter, and she goes on each of these missions and just beats the crap out of everybody. I think in Metroid Prime, one of my absolute favorite moments is when you're going through the various security logs from, like, the space pirates, and you slowly start to realize that the space pirates are scared of her. And that's just so interesting to think about, because you're that character. You know, you're playing as Samus. And yet the enemies that you're facing are, like, sitting there just like, oh, here comes Samus. You know, we're worried about Samus. So that's pretty impressive. It really adds to her kind of mystique. But again, she's allowed to be all these things without then turning around and in some way focusing on her gender. She just is a woman, but there's nothing fixated on about that. So I've always thought that was really cool. And of course, her armor, you know, like visually, that character is just so interesting. Because she's sort of like this hybrid of Iron Man and Boba Fett, like particularly with the helmet. So her look is also just incredibly captivating. And I think her stock, you know, the Varius suit, is pretty cool. But some of the other ones over the years have been really awesome too. Like, I like her fusion design, particularly the pixelated version of it in game, I think looks super, super interesting. Her Phazon suit at the end of Metroid Prime is really cool. But also, like, little touches in Prime, like her, when she rolls into the Morph Ball form, there's a point where I think after she gets the Spider Ball, there's these glowing colored energy bubbles on either side of the ball, and they match whatever color lights are on her armor at that point. That adds such a neat dimension to the Morph Ball, because I've always felt like when Retro was designing that game, they were like, okay, we're not going to see her 80% of the time, so let's make it count every time you do see her. So, like, and then they always include these little moments to make sure you get to see the armor, like when you're going up and down the elevators. But even, like, with the Morph Ball, it's like, how do we make the Morph Ball more interesting? Because there's long chunks where you're navigating, like, the spider rails and all that. And even there, they made her look cool. So for me, it's Samus's personality, and it's also her armor. All of it makes her just this awesome character.
I can appreciate that really the only thing fixated on Samus's gender is Robert's description of the game right now.
Well, I have to explain why. What do you want? Skip to Andrew. Fine.
Okay. I will say that, like, Link is overall my favorite video game character, but I won't focus on Link today. I mean, like, there are a number of characters that we'll each bring up, of course, but I like Link for a number of reasons and just think that he's just a fantastic character, and the different iterations of Link are really cool. And for different reasons, too. But Link aside, one character that really comes to mind is Majima, but specifically the way he was portrayed in Yakuza 0. I was familiar with Majima. You know, Zach had actually introduced me to the Yakuza series. I remember watching him play the games, and I had seen Majima. And I thought he was an interesting character in the other Yakuza games. But when I sat and played 0, he just, like, immediately became one of my favorite characters of all time.
Can you maybe set him up a little? I think, like, everyone probably knows who Samus is, but
yeah. So, I mean, the general premise of the Yakuza games is following, you know, the the story, the drama, because it is such a drama, of these particular Yakuza families. And Majima is the, what's his official title again?
It changes over the course of the series.
But he basically eventually like leads his own family, right?
Yeah, I think he might be a captain by the time you get to the later games.
Yeah, but in the later games, he's portrayed, he's just nuts. He's a little bit like the Joker, which kind of makes it ironic that Mark Hamill voiced him in the English version of the first game.
That's probably why they got him.
Yeah. But he's a little bit of this kind of agent of chaos in certain respects, not 100%, but he's definitely unhinged. And Zero actually kind of explains why he becomes unhinged, but he's crazy and he's over the top and he's unpredictable and he's a bit of a frenemy. He's definitely done some questionable things, but ultimately he's an ally. But he hasn't always 100% been presented that way. But in Zero, you see him as this very young, kind of inexperienced, just kind of grunt in the Yakuza. And he's being punished for something that he did. Yeah, like, I don't want to like give away the whole story, but he's being punished. And Yakuza Zero, of the different storylines it's following, one of them is kind of like Majima coming into his own and becoming the person, the man that he will eventually be later. But what you see in Zero is this kind of different side of him where he's not crazy yet, but it's bubbling under the surface. You know, his nickname is, you know, like Mad Dog of Shimano.
Yeah.
And you come to understand why he's the Mad Dog.
Yeah.
And like the parts at the end where he's really losing it and he's unraveling and he's becoming the Majima that the series, you know, first represented him as, because Yakuza Zero is a prequel and it came out much later than the first games in which this character was introduced. So when you're seeing him unravel and become this completely unhinged guy, it's just fantastic. Like he just has these amazing moments of just losing it, but he's not just losing it. He's reacting to something very hurtful and emotional that happens to him, specifically to somebody that he cares about very much.
Yeah. I didn't see it as him losing it. Like obviously his personality changes.
Yeah.
But I saw it as over the course of Zero, he ends up trying on different pieces of this like Mad Dog persona, and kind of deliberately chooses to be that Mad Dog. Like he finds out he enjoys being that, but also he's like, he is prompted to go in that direction because of things that happen in the story.
Yeah.
But it does feel to me like it's a deliberate choice to like turn on and then relish that persona rather than him like kind of losing it.
Part of it, partly. I don't agree that it's 100% just something he turns on. It's definitely a reaction in some ways to things that are done to him and things that are done to someone that he cares about very, very much. I may even say he loves this person, but yeah, some of it is also a deliberate conscious choice. I think also a pushback on the way that they had kind of leashed him, so to speak. But not many games and really media generally speaking have made me cry or become very emotional. This game at the very end, and in particular something that Majima does, just it had me bawling. I was just like sobbing. I was so embarrassed.
I think we can talk about spoilers. I think, you know, depending on the character we're talking about, it's probably going to be hard to fully explore what...
Yeah, it's been years since that game came out.
That's true.
I'll put a spoiler warning on the episode description.
Okay. So when he, you know, Makoto, the woman that he loves, she has this watch and she tells him that it's broken, but she likes the watch a lot, so she keeps it. And so at the end of the game, you know, after they've gone their separate ways... partly out of necessity, because I think it kind of goes without saying, she would definitely be in danger if he let her stay in his life.
but he leaves her watch. He has the watch repaired and then leaves it for her in the empty lot, which is what the whole game is centered around. It's where the game starts. It's where the events of the game get kicked off, and then where the game ultimately ends. He leaves the watch for her repaired, and she finds it. And it starts playing a little tune, a little melody or something. Either way, she realizes it's fixed, and she starts crying. Because she knows Majima did it. And she's thanking him, even though he's not there. She's alone in the empty lot. That was what made me cry. I mean, partly too, because I wanted them to be together. But also, it was both sad. I mean, it was bittersweet, but it was very sad, but it was also very touching.
They're definitely the best couple in the Yakuza series. And I think it's one of the best, like, obviously there's a tragic element to it, but one of the best romances I've seen in a game.
Yeah, I would agree. This is a fantastic game. It's one of the best games I've ever played. It's one of my all-time favorite games. And in general, you know, the Yakuza series is a very interesting exploration into a lot of things, but especially like into men and masculinity and what, you know, like kind of more traditional masculinity and representations of men, and both the good and the bad at that. And, you know, especially to the way people like to kind of knock down men these days and knock down masculinity. It is a very interesting exploration into male relationships, friendships, how important those are, and just different kind of an interesting exploration into the male psyche in a lot of ways. But it's just a fantastic game. It is amazing, and Majima is a really great character in that game.
Look, I won't pretend there aren't any Yakuza characters on my list to talk about, but let me not jump straight to that. My favorite Final Fantasy protagonist is Squall from Final Fantasy VIII, who is a bit of a loner and really kind of like uncool and bad at expressing his emotions. And I remember thinking at some point in my life, like, I really should have outgrown Squall being my favorite character by now, but like, I don't know. At some level, I wish I identified with him less, but I absolutely adore him. I love in the game. He's got a past which I certainly don't share. I'm also not, obviously didn't grow up a Yakuza or a space bounty hunter, but he grows up. He's orphaned and he gets kind of traumatized by that. And the lesson he takes from feeling abandoned is that he can't ever rely on anybody for help because they'll leave him. But you get what feels like a really realistic rendition of somebody who just keeps pushing people away because he's convinced that he has to do everything himself. So you get to see him like display a kind of strength throughout the game. Like he's much more self-sufficient. He's cool under pressure. That works until it doesn't. Like there are a couple moments in the game where he has a breakdown, including one very funny one where the game kind of sets up a rival character. He's like a cadet at some military academy. He's got a rival cadet, Safer. And Safer becomes like really rebellious and just kind of disappears. And then the party hears that Safer has been executed, and Squall is like watching the rest of the group kind of talk about Safer and kind of eulogize him. They all have had hard histories with Safer also because he's been such an ass to all of them. But Squall has this moment where he just freaks out. You just see thought bubble after thought bubble after thought bubble. He's like, is this how people are going to talk about me when I'm gone? Talking about me like a memory? And then all of a sudden it stops being thoughts and he just yells, like gesturing wildly in the room, I'm not having it, you're not talking about me like that, and runs out. So he's not quite that cool as a cucumber character. It's really like it's presented as like a way to cope with.
He's no Majima, who can be very cool as a cucumber, especially as the manager of the cabaret club.
Well,
he's incredibly smooth and suave.
Yeah, I mean, Majima definitely has his outbursts too.
Well, for sure. Like when he bursts into the room and he's like, something like, you, what does he say? Like,
He's talking about it like his body count. This is something like you fucks don't even.
Oh, you right. You fucks won't even add to my body.
Yeah.
Like you'd be a rounding error on the pile of bodies that I've left behind. Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. But yeah, I mean, obviously, like over the course of the game, I appreciate seeing Squall grow to rely more on other people and to open himself up. I'm not crazy about Rinoa, who is the romantic pairing for Squall, but I do like how she changes Squall. Yeah, I just like Final Fantasy in general, but Squall in particular, I find really relatable, really funny. And I just, he's a bit of a disaster in a way that none of the other classic Final Fantasy protagonists are. Maybe Noctis is kind of a disaster too, but yeah, no, I love that guy.
Robert, you have another one?
Well, I do love Solid Snake. I actually don't really care much for Big Boss. You know, they're sometimes kind of treated almost like they're the same. It's like they're not the same character. Like, Solid's different. They're obviously similar to one another, and they look almost identical. But Solid, to me, is just more fascinating with his... Because, like, Big Boss has that extra baggage of he goes on to kind of become a bad guy in different ways. And whereas Snake is always just trying to do the right thing. And he can be a little cliche. You know, he has the Clint Eastwood kind of thing going on. And the whole, oh, you know, I'm not a good person. But everyone's like, yeah, you're a good person. You know, it's like everyone you've killed deserved it. So, but he obsesses over thinking he's not this good person because of what he's had to do in the name of, like, fighting these different battles he's had to fight. I just think it's kind of a shame, though, that Solid has really only had... Well, I'm trying to think. I guess when you get to Metal Gear, like I'm talking like the original Metal Gear, that's Solid, right?
Yeah, yeah. Metal Gear and Metal Gear 2.
But his personality really solidifies in Metal Gear Solid on PlayStation. And you really only get two games of him. You know, you get that, and then you get Metal Gear 4. And between those two games, well, no, I guess I'm forgetting Metal Gear Solid 2 as well. Those trio of games with him, he's really entertaining. And I don't know, part of it is, see, I'm weird. Like, there's character moments that draw me to characters that I like and all that. Part of it, though, is the visual aspect of it. I just think Snake looks so damn cool. Like, yeah. His sneaking suit in the first game is still my favorite. He looks pretty badass in the fourth game as well. You have to mess with the color combo just right. But, man, there's nothing more satisfying than going through Metal Gear 4 after you get the camouflage for his the face camo where you can make him look like Young Snake. And you just make him look like Young Snake the entire game. It's like, oh, okay, I'm playing it again.
So I haven't played Metal Gear Solid 4, but that kind of sounds like defeating the purpose.
Oh, not
no,
at all.
No.
Don't you... Like, no. The story is, to some degree, about coming to grips with him being old.
No,
right?
See,
I refuse to come to grips with him being old, so that's why it's
because
great.
You refuse to come to grips with you getting old.
Maybe.
See, the thing is that Zach doesn't really like cool things.
That's not true.
The cooler, the worse.
No. Snake is super cool in Metal Gear Solid. Like,
No. What I mean is that Zach is not really, like, there's a common theme in every single one of my characters that I will bring up, for the most part. Is that they're all cool, or at least in my opinion. And even the two that Robert brought up, Samus and Solid Snake, super cool. It's not that Zach doesn't appreciate that, it's just, it seems almost like a lot of his favorite characters are kind of not that. And like when we've been like, oh yeah, so-and-so's so cool, Meta Knight's so cool.
Yeah, Meta Knight. This man doesn't like Meta Knight.
Yeah, and Zach's just like, no, not cool. No.
I mean, Meta Knight's not cool. Meta Knight is dorky as hell. Solid Snake is actually really cool, though. Like,
he is.
Yeah. Like, I really like the first Metal Gear Solid. I really like Snake's characterization. And, like, he's not... Like, the game can make him the butt of a joke and still make him look cool. The game can put him in all kinds of character combinations, and they all work for him. He doesn't have, like, the flamboyant charisma of Liquid, but he still comes off looking cool in every interaction that he has.
I think that... The relationship with the Liquid is fascinating because they are like these kind of like opposites in terms of everything from like their hair to their personalities.
That first game is really balanced. Like, part of what makes Snake so cool is looking at how he interacts with everybody in the first game particularly. Like, that game had just such a perfect cast of bad guys and allies. And, like, it doesn't matter who he's interacting with, it kind of gives you some insight into Snake, and it makes you like him even more. And my first intro to the original Metal Gear was Twin Snakes on GameCube, which I know most people who've played the original prefer the PlayStation version, but I love him in Twin Snakes, and all the, like, fight scenes are so cool in that version, and especially when he's taking on forgetting his name. Grey Wolf? Cyborg Ninja.
Yeah. Cyborg Ninja,
you wouldn't call him Cyborg Ninja.
Yeah, but that's not his name.
You want to call him Grey Fox?
Grey Fox, that's what it is. Grey Fox, Frank Yeager, Cyborg Ninja. Oh, man. Those battles are so awesome. Anyway, so Snake's number two. Okay. This list is in no particular order, I guess. I'm also like Angela. Link's another one who... I don't know if I'd say he's my absolute favorite, but I love Link. But see, with Link, it kind of depends on the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're all different Links.
So Ocarina of Time Link is my favorite. And then Twilight Princess Link would probably be second. And then a third place tie would probably go to, like, Majora's Mask and Wind Waker Links.
For me, Wind Waker Link is way out in front. I, like...
How he's less cooler than the other two.
Well, no. I mean, I think he's a lot more relatable. He's got... I've never been as emotionally invested in a Zelda game as Wind Waker Link, like, setting out to and then succeeding in saving his sister. Mm. I think the most emotionally cathartic moment I've had in a Zelda game is smashing... I forget its name. That's the big
Rock.
Bird. Yeah.
Mm.
Smashing that bird's... face in with the giant skull hammer.
Yeah, it's a pretty epic boss battle. They need to bring that to Switch.
For me, my favorite Links are Ocarina Link, Adult Link, and then Young Link, and then Twilight Princess Link. I think Young Link, you know, like, I... Even in, like, whether it's video games or media, a kid has to really be... really cool, or just really something about that kid has to be unique for me to be invested in or care about a kid character. I don't know why, I just find them way less appealing. But Young Link is just the most badass, just coolest little kid ever. I just think he's awesome. And I just think it's really funny how in Smash Bros. Melee they give him little green shorts under his tunic. I just think that's really cute for some reason.
Young Link is ferocious right out of the gate. Like, he realizes he's been repressed the whole time he's been in Kiri Village. It's like, Mido's telling me what to do. He's gonna take it on the Stelfos.
I've been abused. I've been made fun of.
Yeah, everybody's beating the crap out of. He's just seeing Mido's face. Yeah. Till he runs into Ganon, and then it's like, oh. Now I have found someone new to hate.
Yeah, you. Well, I guess Link is a freebie for everyone. Did you have another character?
Yeah. I almost feel like I'm, like, stealing this from Zach in a way, because I only know of him thanks to Zach, but Geralt. So Yakuza 0 and Witcher 3 are two of my favorite games of all time, both thanks to Zach. I remember with Yakuza... it was just in the background. I barely even remembered Yakuza, because when I worked at GameStop in college, I would put that game on the walls when I was doing the walls. And I remember saying, you know, whatever Yakuza it was at the time, like putting the empty case on the wall and just knowing the games from that. But then Zach started playing Zero, and it was just on in the background, and, you know, I was doing whatever. And then, you know, the cutscenes would come on. The game is beautiful, so it caught my attention. But then I started, you know, reading the subtitles and kind of getting drawn in. I was like, you know what? I think I want to play this game myself. This story is really interesting. And it was the same with The Witcher 3. Zach had it on, but I could hear it because everyone's speaking English rather than Japanese. And the voice acting is fantastic in that game. I mean, except for Triss and Dandelion. Awful. Trash.
Geralt.
And both trash characters. But... but other than them, the game is just a solid 10 out of 10. It's just fantastic. And so that was another one where I ended up playing it myself.
And Geralt is just amazing. Now, I didn't play the first two Witcher games, so I'm only talking about Geralt in The Witcher 3. He is amazing.
He's another Clint Eastwood type.
He is another Clint Eastwood type. And Clint Eastwood's like my favorite. I don't really care for celebrities very much, but Clint Eastwood is just, he's almost anti-celebrity. He's such an interesting person. But no, Geralt is amazing. He just has this attitude. Like, it's almost hard to describe Geralt. He is a little sarcastic, maybe a lot sarcastic, a little bit of a smartass. He also has a temper, but not like explosive temper like a Majima. He's like a quiet temper. Like when he's confronting Horsun Jr.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically tells him very quietly, "I'm tired. It took a long time to find you. And if you don't give me the answers I'm looking for, I'm going to rip your balls off." And he just delivers it very deadpan. And he's threatening without, you know, being like saber rattling threatening. He's also very interesting, too, because Geralt has a sense of morality, although you as the player can choose. Do you want him to be a good person, or do you want him to be more self-serving?
Within a band. Like, it's not just, you know, in some games, they'll make fun of like the dialogue options where it's all just like the same thing, but like nice, sarcastic, right?
Yeah.
Or quip, right?
Right. Like, but there are some things about him that are pretty standard no matter what choices you make. Kind of like, Geralt's really not willing to help unless the coin is right. And I think it's actually a phrase he uses multiple times, being, you know, the coin is right.
He does, although he's not honest with it, because like there are a lot of cases where he will
do things out of the goodness of his heart, or because he thinks it's the right thing to do. But it is very interesting how he does have that sense of right and wrong, and he very much has a strong sense of right and wrong. But then there's also part of him that's just like, if you don't have the coin, I'm not doing this. And, you know, I mean, I don't blame him. It's his job. But very interesting how he came to be, you know, the Trials of the Grasses? Or the Trial of the Grasses?
Trial of the Grasses,
yeah.
One of several steps in becoming a Witcher.
Yeah. You know, him being this kind of prodigal child who was able to survive the whole process, really. It wasn't just about being a prodigal. But I just think he's an amazing character. And it's also interesting, too, how he's exploring fatherhood in the third game, but not. It's certainly not. What's the word I'm thinking of? It's not your typical kind of story of fatherhood. But I just think Geralt's a fantastic character. I think his overall character design is great. So
he is. He's like a cowboy hero,
mm-hmm.
right? I think even more than, you know, you can look at Solid Snake and see comparisons to the like Clint Eastwood type persona, but with Geralt it's more like the entire structure of the game is him as like a wandering cowboy or wandering Ronin.
Geralt is far and away one of my very favorite characters. I just think he's amazing.
He's very good.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's at his best in Witcher 3.
I also, just a quick aside, I don't have enough about Yennefer to say to dedicate an entire slot to her, but I love Yennefer, and I think she and Geralt's romance is fantastic. Fuck Triss. She's awful. I don't care. I don't care how many people that upsets. Triss can rot in hell.
You know it's possible to like Yennefer without disliking Triss.
No.
Yeah, it is.
No. Also, I relate to Yennefer in some ways. Her temper, her mm-hmm. strong opinions on things,
mm-hmm.
her appreciation of black outfits.
Yeah, her obsession with a certain small subset of the color spectrum. Right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I see it.
Constantly wearing perfume. I think she's wonderful.
I am going to the next protagonist character I want to celebrate. I played a bunch of the Assassin's Creed games in the past year. Although it wasn't my favorite game, I was really, really into the story, and especially the lead character of Assassin's Creed 3. which is the one that takes place in like the colonial America. Mm-hmm. The protagonist, Connor Kenway, is actually one of the least liked protagonists in the series, as I understand it, because he's partly because he's a direct follow-up to the games with Ezio, mm-hmm. who is this really like flamboyantly, loudly entertaining ladies' man adventurer, swashbuckling type. And Connor Kenway is super stoic. He's like very deliberately calm in his bearing and his manner. It can seem kind of flat, but you can tell if you're paying attention that he's pushing down a lot of anger when he talks. His story, it very briefly sketched, is like he's half Mohawk Indian and half English. So his dad was kind of like a rich colonist. And there was kind of like just like a tryst. So he didn't know his dad growing up. So he grew up as a Mohawk, and it's on the frontier. And like during the time of the French and Indian War, basically his village gets destroyed, and he swears, he's a kid at the time, he swears to revenge himself upon Charles Lee, who was the guy he blames for it. People mock, lovingly or otherwise, how often Connor demands to know where Charles Lee is or declare that he's going to kill Charles Lee. Like, you can find supercuts of this on YouTube. Like, where is Charles Lee? One of the funniest parts of the game for me is you end up in possession of a ship. I don't know what kind it is, but it can hold cannons and is capable of ship-to-ship combat. And you're looking for a captain run the ship for you. And you end up in some random bar in, like, I don't know, Cape Cod or whatever. And the guy you're with who's like, tries to like go talk to the bartender to see if there's like a captain that they can talk to or something like that. I can't remember the details, but he's like talking for 10 seconds, turns around, and Connor is like hands down on a table in the bar, like accosting somebody he kind of remembers seeing before. Where is Charles Lee? It's like, you can't leave this guy alone for 10 seconds. But yeah, I really like the story. It's kind of got this like great American novel vibe where he's like, he's trying to like save his village, make up for the trauma, make up for like losing his mom in that attack, mm-hmm. and allies himself with like George Washington and like the pro-independence colonial forces. And the further you get in the game, the more you realize how futile it is. Like, the frontier is going to get eaten up either by England or by America. Mm-hmm. And he's just got to come to terms with the fact that the home that he knew is never coming back. But he can't quite let go of his quest for revenge. Mm. It just ends up not killing him, but kind of, it just leaves him with kind of like sand falling through his fingers. He doesn't get the feeling. He doesn't get what he's after. Mm. There's a bright side too. He ends up building like his own homestead, his own village of frontiersmen and travelers over the course of the game. So he ends up building something new. It's not all sad, but I do really like his obsession with vengeance, his stoicism, and just kind of like the bittersweet nature of the game. I really like Connor.
So in terms of like, you know, in-depth characters, like I love for like these deep story reasons, I don't have a lot that I can really point to. Like for me, there's character moments, and it's those little moments that's all it takes for me to like a character. So like, I think a good example would be McTavish, AKA Soap, mm-hmm. in the Modern Warfare games. Mm-hmm. So Soap is one of the people you play as in the first Modern Warfare, and then he becomes like one of the like lead guys in Modern Warfare 2, who's like above your character. Mm-hmm. But man, one of the best moments in that entire franchise of Call of Duty is when you go, I think it's the Gulag, and you're going to break out a specific prisoner. And so you are going in to break him out, and you're like, you go through the whole level, and it's incredibly intense. It's like one of the most intense moments or levels in the entire series. By the time you go to rescue him, you realize he's strangling somebody to death with the chains that are holding him. And then you realize it's Price from the first game. Now, Price was Soap's commanding officer. Mm. So as you're playing Modern Warfare 2, I don't think it's until that moment that you realize, unless you recall the first game, that the McTavish they keep talking about is soap. And so when Price sees him, he says, he's like, soap? And you just kind of laugh because it's like, so Price's ass has been in jail for all this time in the frickin' gulag, you know, but he's still staying, you know, fit and deadly. And then McTavish, who's like a total badass throughout all of Modern Warfare 2, when he gets to Price, Price still looks at him as like, oh, that's the guy who was under me. It's so, it's just such a funny moment. But they're both so incredibly likable. And especially as you play through the rest of the game, both those characters are really well done. But then, like, Mario, right? So I love Link. Mario's another one I throw in. But Mario is like kind of a cipher.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the RPG games, he has personality, but kind of doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think the personality for him and Luigi shine through the most in the Mario and Luigi RPG games.
Oh, yeah.
But
a lot of butt wiggling.
Yeah.
Yeah, dancing, the fake Italian that they speak.
The way they move their hands while they're speaking, too.
Mario's another one where just like the little moments with him, like Super Mario RPG especially, went a long way towards establishing the personality that he does have. Mm-hmm. Because the 2D games, none of them really give you much. But then you get to that game and he's just so cute and like innocent mm-hmm. and good-hearted. And the interplay between him and all the different sidekicks are just so great. Especially when Bowser shows up.
Oh my god, yeah.
So Bowser is definitely on the list of beloved characters because he is just so maniacal and has this huge ego. And it's so funny when he decides that he's going to demean himself and team up with Mario.
Yeah.
But it's always in his own best interests.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's like a larger situation like Mario RPG where it's like, we're all going to die. So you have to, but it's still in his mind. It's like, well, I have to preserve myself. It's like, you know, I can't admit I'm trying to save everybody.
I also love that he is just so resentful that Smithy has kicked him out of his own castle.
Yep.
He is just so enraged by that. I also love the moments where Bowser's crying in those games and it's comical and like the tears, like one drops and then one raises. It's just so funny.
Yeah, so that's... that's another example of something, like another character where Bowser, there's definitely been more characterization with him. And I love Fox from the Star Fox game, so Fox McCloud. But it's the four of them together that is what makes them all so entertaining. It's like that endless back and forth with the dialogue. It's always so well done, but like especially Star Fox 64. I mean, that remains the high watermark for the series, but Fox is just super cool.
Fox is really cool.
And like, this kind of doesn't count because it's my own writing, but for the Nintendojo site, I have this team up I did where it's just like a fan fiction, basically, and it's the Star Fox team and Samus. And man, I loved writing that because I was able to like get into everybody's heads and make them sound the way that I think that they should and do. And so, like, it was kind of fun because Samus is sort of, like, not resentful, but Samus is a lone wolf. Like, she doesn't want to work as part of a team. That's just how she is. But being forced to work with the others, like, it was fun seeing them all trying to keep up. But then also Fox, like, being this sort of diplomat where it's, like, Fox knows that he's competent and he knows his team is competent. But then also having to, like, sort of... stick up for them with Samus, who's still like, you all still can't keep up with me.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we can, but we just have to try a little harder. And so part of my love for Fox comes from that experience of writing him.
I agree with you that I really like the rapport that the team of four has. So much so, and also I like their character designs. I think they're really well done. And, you know, World of Nintendo a few years back, when that line of toys first came out, they came out with all four members of Team Star Fox. And I have all four. And I have a couple of different curio cabinets with a bunch of my video game collectibles set up. And I have all four of them standing. I also like that they can actually stand. Because, you know, some figures just can't stand. But they can stand on their own. And so I have them lined up all four side by side. And of everything I own, of all of my collectibles, that set of four is one of my very favorites. I love that set, and they look so neat standing together.
I remember when Fox came out, I was like, oh, it'd be cool if they do Falco too. But then after Falco came out, I think Slippy was next. And I was just like, oh, they're going to do all four of them. Yep. I was like, oh, that's hella cool. Like, in my life, I never thought I'd see all four of them. Because, like, growing up, like, if you're, you know, if you're younger and you're listening to this, you're spoiled with Nintendo toy options. Mm-hmm. Like, as kids, there wasn't anything. Mm-hmm. Like, there were these random toys that would come out. Like, we have the Mario Kart 64 toys mm-hmm. that came out, at, you know, when that game came out. And they're ridiculously valuable because they're rare. Mm-hmm. But, like, what you don't understand is that when those came out, to me, they were, like, the holy grail of toys. Because mm-hmm. it wasn't just that they were Mario Kart. It was like, hey, the figure actually comes with it, too. Mm-hmm. So you can actually play with the toys. And, you know, there was no action figures to get of any of these characters before that other than, like, the McDonald's 3. The McDonald's Super Mario Brothers 3 toys. And then the Mario movie toys.
Yep.
That was it. So seeing Star Fox action figures, it blew my mind. I was like, this is amazing.
So I got nothing really to positive to say about the Star Fox character.
Yeah, he's a hater. Yeah. More cool, anti-cool talk.
And seeing as this is like the character episode and not the vintage toy episode.
Look, I'm just, that's just a quick aside.
Okay. Anyway.
But whoever thought that they'd get like a peppy action figure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have maybe a last hero before we move on to villains?
So I'll do an actual one and then an honorable mention. Oh no, I just lost it.
Well, you can do the quick aside first, see what happens.
I got it. Okay, sorry. Cloud. Mm-hmm. I like Cloud a lot. I feel sorry for Cloud because I don't know. I mean, he seems, he's very interesting because, you know, he's clearly defensive and he puts up walls, and part of his sarcasm comes from that. It's his defense mechanism, but it's also got to be really, really something to realize that, you know, the things that you think are true are not true. The things that you think about yourself and things you've built up your own identity around are not actually true. Final Fantasy VII is a fantastic game. I don't really need to get into why. It's like talking about why Ocarina of Time is great. But Cloud in particular, I just found very interesting. And just some of the things he says are just so funny to me. His attitude is just really funny. And his relationship with Tifa, because obviously he's supposed to be with Tifa and not Aerith or Aerith.
How much of this podcast have you devoted to OTPs and bashing,
tearing down the character she hates?
Just say, you know, but his relationship with Tifa is very sweet. And
golly, shilly, shilly.
That's not canon. That's not canon.
Oh, Zach despises Advent children.
Yeah.
But
was it?
Yeah. A good son would have known. But his relationship with Tifa is something I really, really like. It's one of my favorite relationships, whether romantic or platonic, in video games. I just think that Cloud is a fascinating character. Again, I think his character design is awesome. I think he's super cool. But just it's interesting playing as someone who is having this mental break. And is not he's existing under false pretenses. You see him having these moments where he's questioning things, and he passes out more than once, and he's not well. It's just a very interesting experience playing as Cloud. The honorable mention goes to Leon from Resident Evil.
Yeah, I was going to, if you didn't mention it, I was going to say, we have to make sure to mention him before moving on to the villains.
Yeah.
Leon S. Kennedy.
You know.
It's weird how he's so much of like a creation of the localization.
Yeah, you know, because I was just about to say, Leon is not, he's not very deep or anything as a character. He's just a fantastic character. His look in Resident Evil 4 is so good. It's obviously better when he loses the jacket, but he's just this sarcastic ass, particularly in 4 and especially compared to 6, but like, just, you know, the he has so many classic lines, you know,
entering the village and thinks he's going to get into a fight, thinks he's in danger. And then the bells ring, church bells ring, and all the ganado go away. And you know, he looks around and he goes, where's everyone going?
I Bingo. Like, yeah.
It's a mouthful.
I like. I really like that. Like he's a little dorky.
Yes. You
know, like his taste in one-liners is not quite correct.
Yes.
You know, but he's got the competence to pull it off anyhow. So you get kind of it's almost like with you know, blue cheese or other fermented foods where there's just like something off there, but the whole package works. Like
yes.
his taste in quips is not quite right.
I knew you'd be fine if you landed on your butt.
It's interesting because Leon, you know, if you think about it, he is the end result of massive traumatization in Resident Evil 2. So yeah. It's like after going through that, it's no wonder you get to 4 and he's like, oh yeah, I don't give a shit anymore. Like nothing scares me. Like I just went through an entire city full of zombies and all this other crap. It's like, I can deal with an Eastern European village and a castle.
You know how six...
An island.
Like well, six starts with, like, the president and a zombie.
Yeah.
And he's like, stay back, Mr. President.
Mr. President.
And like, it's just ridiculous at that point. Because he's been through Resident Evil 2 and he's been through Resident Evil 4. And you're like,
what
you know
happening here?
Yeah.
How this works.
Maybe he'll get better.
Dude.
Maybe I can talk sense into him.
Let me just get you some ibuprofen.
Well, also...
Ivermectin. Now this episode of the podcast, I'll have a COVID warning.
I was going to say... or HCQ. No, when he... I don't know if it's intentional or not, and I don't know if anyone's actually explained this or explored this, but... Luis is clearly Luis, not Louis. But and then it's just so comical when Luis gets killed and he just yells into the air, Luis! It's like, is it supposed to be that he is, you know, a little stupid and a little like just he also probably just doesn't care either
Luis
way.
Pulls him close before he dies.
It's Luis Gringo.
It's Luis, yeah. But yeah, so that's. I've always thought that was funny because I've never known. Was it a matter of the directing team and the voice acting team not telling what's his name? I can't remember the voice actor's name right now. It's Luis. He's like vaguely Spanish. Or them just being like, no, actually deliberately call him Luis. Don't call him Luis. Or if they were like, you know, it's a mistake, but it actually works really well with this character. So we're going to leave it. I don't know. All are possibilities, and I don't know if anyone's ever actually looked into that. But
my guess is it was just sloppy, but I think it works.
Yeah.
So yeah, Leon. I guess, you know, Chris Redfield should get a shout out. That guy punched a boulder. You know, it never dawned on me until years later, one of my friends mentioned that scene at the end of Resident Evil 5. And they were saying, you know, Chris punches the boulder. And I'm like, he does? And they're like, yeah. And so I think I just YouTubed it or something, and I'm like, oh, yeah. And like, when you're playing the game, you know, you go through quite a bit to get up to that point. And I personally wasn't even thinking about it. Like, yeah, just hammer the button, you know, punch the boulder, get it over. And it's like, then later you realize he was punching a boulder. That's not how it works.
Well, you know, this is actually a good segue into our favorite enemies. Because speaking of Resident Evil 5, you know, this is the moment our podcast is named after, and Albert Wesker.
Yeah, he's all right. I don't know if I'd put him on my list.
He's not on my top, but, you
know. we can give him a little respect.
A little respect.
Okay. I do have...
7 minutes.
I do have one last...
7 minutes is all the time I have to play with you, Chris.
All right.
Zach.
Now that we've
waiting
said grace.
Very impatiently.
Now that we've said grace. Let's dig in to Zach's final hero pick, and I'm gonna loop it in with one of Zach's villain picks also.
Okay,
I guess a pair. Going back to the well of Yakuza. Look, I do like Majima a lot, especially in Zero, but to me, the heart of the series is undoubtedly Kiryu.
Kiryu,
I love that dude. He's
Kiryu-chan.
He's got the right mix of gruff, angry, Lunkhead. with Idealist, with like Goofy Virgin. Like yeah. There's a lot of weird things in the mix of Kiryu's character.
He's fantastic.
They should have kept his outfit from the start of Zero.
I agree.
He looked way cooler.
I agree. I really do wish they would have kept that black suit because Zero was so cool.
Was the sixth game made. Yeah. They couldn't keep it.
They finally got it right after making the sixth game.
Wait, why couldn't they keep it?
Because that didn't technically come first.
No. Oh, no. Sorry. I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood you, Robert. I thought what I'm saying is I wish that in Zero, like throughout Zero.
Oh, that he just kept the black suit.
Oh, I just wish the whole series he was in that outfit.
Oh, well, that too. So freaking cool. That too, yeah.
All right. Anyhow, for me, I really like the whole series kind of romanticizes the Yakuza in some ways.
Yes.
But it also
remind people they're not exactly good people.
Yeah, but obviously it criticizes them too. And I feel like Kiryu is a really good vehicle for that because he is kind of, the way I see it, is Kiryu is like a representation of the romantic ideal of the Yakuza. Like the tough man who's willing to do what it takes to protect the people he mm-hmm. loves, to stand mm-hmm. by his brothers, etc.
Yeah.
And then characters like Kusei from Zero are more like, not that I have ever interacted with the Yakuza, but I take that to be representative more of like the true face of the Yakuza, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like ruthless, willing to hurt people, kind of relishes hurting people.
Many of the characters in the Yakuza series are likable in the way that Michael Corleone and other people in The Godfather are likable. Like we're aware of the fact that they're organized crime, that the mafia in real life has done some very terrible, horrible things, but it's fiction.
But I really like that Kiryu doesn't fit. He's a perfect protagonist because he doesn't fit in the world of the Yakuza, but he is strong enough and strong-willed enough that he can stand up to like the inevitability of the society around him and kind of like bend it to his will,
mm-hmm.
which really fits with like the beat-em-up gameplay. It fits with like the preposterous stories in all of these games.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like him paired with, I wonder if I'd feel differently if I'd played the PS2 games before I played Zero,
mm-hmm.
but I really like the contrast between Kiryu and Nishiki, mm-hmm. who is on my favorite villains list.
Yeah,
you know, he's not a villain in Zero.
No,
but you get this contrast between the two of them, where Nishiki, like Kiryu, is like a good guy at heart,
mm-hmm.
but Nishiki is just weak. He kind of needs Kiryu in order to survive in that dark world.
Mm.
And at the start of Kiwami, Yakuza 1, following Yakuza 0, Nishiki commits a murder. And Kiryu decides that Nishiki isn't strong enough to handle going to prison. So Kiryu turns himself in instead.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens, ironically, is that Nishiki is no longer has Kiryu around and ends up, in order to survive, Nishiki has to conform himself to the laws of the Yakuza, basically, to become a ruthless man, to become that monster. And so I like the way that those, like, Kiryu can rise above and Nishiki gets ground down, and they kind of like, it's tragic. And Zero especially is really tragic if you've played Kiwami, like the way mm-hmm. Nishiki is treating Kiryu throughout the game.
Because you know what ends up happening to Nishiki.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, both Nishiki and Kiryu, they really don't belong in the Yakuza. It's just through a series of events that they wound up there. But Nishiki, even more so than Kiryu, he doesn't belong there. He is too gentle. He is too weak. And then by extension, he's too easily manipulated. It is sad, and he is a very tragic character.
Yeah. Majima is an interesting contrast because he does seem like he was born to be a Yakuza in comparison. Like, he relishes it so much.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I want to start with an honorable mention because I know that I'll forget it if I don't mention it now. Ganondorf is fantastic because he's such a bastard. But in particular in Wind Waker, he's especially great. And the scene where he's reading Zelda's dreams, he can see them and he's describing them. And then the monologue he has where he talks about being from the desert and the harshness and everything is one of my very favorite moments in any game. And I think Ganondorf is, he's a fantastic character. His character design in Ocarina is by far the best, but his representation as a character in Wind Waker is fantastic. But in terms of enemies, what's his last name? It's is it Olgierd von Emmerich?
Everick.
In The Witcher 3. That DLC is called...
Heart of Stone.
And Olgierd is one of my favorite characters in any game. He is also a very tragic character. Someone who is very humbled. An interesting story about... not that this would actually really... Not anything anyone really needs to be worried about in real life, but a cautionary tale against getting into a deal with the devil. The Man of Glass, who is basically strongly, heavily implied to be the devil, has an incredibly interesting dynamic with him and Geralt. And he himself has a lot of really good moments. But Olgierd and... What is his wife's name again?
Iris,
yeah. Their whole entire story is just riveting. I look forward to doing the Heart of Stone DLC whenever I play Witcher 3, because the storytelling is so good and their story is so incredibly sad. Their run down, essentially haunted house, it is haunted by Iris's restless, angry, distraught, sad spirit. The dog and the cat that are basically demons that are watching over her. But Olgierd, and it's just so interesting because he definitely is remorseful, but at the same time, he almost isn't.
Well, that's part of the curse, right? Is he lost his ability to feel.
And but even if he could feel, I don't know exactly, just given the kind of man he was, I don't really know that he actually would be 100% remorseful. And that in itself is tragic because he really did love Iris. And it's sad to think that despite loving her so much that he wouldn't necessarily totally regret everything he did and everything he did to her. His character design is fantastic. I love the way he looks, his outfit, even his hair that I would think would look stupid on a regular person looks really good on him. And his voice actor is amazing. That was such a good casting. And I think overall, like Olgierd, his character, his story, his whole entire arc, it's worth playing through Witcher 3 just so you can then do that DLC. It's really good.
Yeah, it's actually, Heart of Stone is my least favorite part of the game on replay. But it's not because it's not good. I think it's like the strongest story in the game. It's just a more story focused, less like combat focused. So sure. It's like the balance on replay is a little bit, I don't know.
I also like kind of creepy, what's the word, the macabre things. So it really speaks to me there. But
yeah.
Yeah.
No, he's great. And you look at them as a pair also, Olgierd and Gaunter.
Yes.
But even just either of them.
Gaunter Odim.
Either of them on their own are really strong.
Yes.
Yeah.
One enemy or bad guy I really like is, I do like Revolver Ocelot. He's fascinating in the first game because he's like the maniac torture expert or whatever. But I especially love him in Metal Gear Solid 3 when he's interacting with Big Boss that entire time. Because like there's this sort of weird relationship right off the bat where you can see Snake is amused by him because he shows up with these stupid... Well, actually, I think at first he just has some normal, like, Beretta-style handguns. And Snake tells him, you'd be better off with a revolver. He takes it to heart, what Snake tells him, because clearly something about Snake is appealing to Ocelot. And so, like, establishing that whole history in that first... well, not first game, but the third game, but chronologically, it's the first story with all of them. And so you just see this interesting evolution of the character throughout the whole series. And then the third game, I love how he shows up with the revolvers later, but they're like these ornamental revolvers. And Snake makes fun of him and is like, what's with all this extra, you know, crap basically all over your guns? Like, just get some normal revolvers. And then that's what he ends up using throughout the rest of the series. But then, you know, there's the complexities of the weird double, triple agent stuff going on, because in Metal Gear Solid 5, Ocelot's actually helping you, and he's on the mother base, assisting, like, with training everybody and whatever, but he's always just so fascinating and always really well played. No matter who's doing the part, Because that one guy, whose name I can never remember, he's in like every video game. He plays him in Metal Gear Solid 5. He does a good job with him. And then, he's one of my favorite enemies. Oh, and in terms of Ganon, it's fascinating because Wind Waker, when it came out, was supposed to be... I got the sense from that game that they really thought they were going to start doing something different with the Zelda series because mm-hmm. they leave Hyrule underwater and we're going to go find our own Hyrule. And then you get Twilight Princess, which is exactly like the opposite. It's like, you know, you're back in Hyrule and it's hyper-realistic. But like the course correction from Twilight Princess, from Wind Waker is clearly intentional because people were just so outraged when they saw the Wind Waker demo. But, like, when that game came out, like, you ended up realizing, oh, this is actually amazing. You know, the art style really works. Now, I prefer the Zelda series to kind of go back and forth. I do like it realistic more than anything. But Wind Waker, after it came out, cemented itself as one of my all-time favorite Zeldas. And part of it is Ganon being so fascinating.
What do you like about that Ganon?
He just seems a little more nuanced than the other ones. Like that scene Angie was talking about where mm-hmm. he's reading Zelda's dreams. And, I don't know, like it's kind of funny when you get to the end, right? And you get into that final battle with him and Link. Cause it's like, he's trying to murder a child.
Yeah.
Like he straight up like really feels like a child in that game. And Ganon wants him dead, but...
Well, he also... the way he fights in that final battle is so cool. It's so fluid, and he's so intimidating.
Yeah, very intimidating.
Super cool.
But,
I also love that part where Rock has Link, and you haven't officially seen Ganondorf, yet, but he just gives the head, get the hell out of here, and Rock just tosses him, it's just that little head movement by Ganondorf, that flippant, dismissive, I don't care what you do with him, because you got the wrong kid, just tosses him aside, it's so good.
I do like the Wind Waker version of Ganon, because it feels, the end feels more focused on Ganon's mistaken desires than on just like this raw like clash of this hero versus monster. You know, it feels like you see the conflict between the king and Ganon and Ganon's own frustration and Ganon being kind of like entombed in stone and like I do like the focus more on like Ganon, like the person being defeated, whereas in like Ocarina it feels more like Ganon, a monster, has been slain.
Well, that's particularly true in Breath of the Wild. They really totally drop the ball with presenting any kind of meaningful narrative around Ganon himself in that game. He's just the boogeyman, you know? And, like, he's incredibly scary looking, especially at the end, where it's, like, this truly monstrous version of him. Like, not even, like, the usual pig monster Ganon. It's, like, he's this deformed creature, but you get like no insight into him throughout that game, so it's like it feels like such a waste,
because even the storytelling in an earlier game like Ocarina of Time is certainly more advanced than anything that came before it, but there are still some limitations just in terms of like graphics and graphical capabilities and technological capabilities, but
space but
Ganondorf gets some really good moments in that game. His interactions with young Link, the way that he dismisses Phantom Ganon, is just like, wow, what a waste of time banishing you to the gap between dimensions. I really like when you think that you've killed Ganondorf and he has that one final card up his sleeve. He can't say anything. He's like too weak. He has really nothing left in him, but he just shows you the back of his hand that he still has the Triforce of Power, almost as if to say, I mean, he's essentially saying like, you thought you killed me, you can't, but it's just this like really, it's just a really good moment of him just like holding up the back of his hand and showing you he has the Triforce of Power and then turning into Ganon.
I think you guys are being a little too mean to the Breath of the Wild Ganon. I don't think it's dropping the ball. I think they're just trying to do something different with it.
No, they failed.
Uh-huh.
Well, all this other intensive narrative building, and it's like, oh, and then here's Ganon.
Well, let me give a lighter villain choice. Not the same kind of stuff I've been talking about for most of these, but like the King of All Cosmos from the Katamari games. Just this like really strange judgmental dad. I really like his characterization. I like his really crazy design too, but just the idea that he got drunk on it, like went on a bender and accidentally destroyed all the stars in the sky. Like that's the premise of the game. Is it, you know, we got a little wasted, royally wasted. Now, Prince. But yeah, I mean, obviously, he's not quite the same kind of villain as a lot of the other things we've been talking about, but just is this ridiculous comic but stern presence in the game. I love him. I love how belittling he is, but also how meticulous he is in measuring and judging each of the Katamari you bring to him. Yeah, I think he's great. I think he's great.
Well, my next choice was also something that I first, a character I was first introduced to by Zach, and I thought she was fantastic from the moment I saw her. It's Yatsuyu from Final Fantasy XIV. She's like gorgeous and elegant, and she has this just beautiful dress and her very sophisticated, you know, long cigarette holder. But wow, what an evil, nasty bitch. She is so mean and so cruel and so calculating. And I just think that she's fantastic. I think she's amazing. You know, ultimately she gets what she deserves. She really doesn't deserve a happy ending given the things that she does. But I think she's a really cool character, and maybe some people think it's weird that I like her for how evil and mean she is, but I actually think it makes her very interesting.
No, I don't think that's weird at all. I think you like a lot of the best villains are kind of a mix of love to hate and love to watch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's interesting too, you know, that moment she has with, man, he has such a long name, but the blonde haired guy, the evil guy
Oh, Xenos?
Yeah, Xenos. I guess I could have just said Xenos, but I just think of his entire name flashing across the screen. But when he grabs her by the hair and he's basically dragging her across the floor, although he really is just kind of holding her up by the hair, having long hair, I know how much that would hurt, but it's supposed to be especially painful because he's so strong. And he's telling her, you know, you fucked up. Everything that happened is exactly what you were supposed to have prevented from happening. You do it again and basically you're dead. And how that makes her blood boil. Like, it makes her so angry and so intent on getting revenge on the people that caused her to disappoint Xenos mm-hmm. to begin with. Mm-hmm. It's just such a quintessential moment for her, and this very good example of how just how nasty she is. She's great.
I would just like to update my comments on Revolver, because I feel like sometimes we might be a little vague sometimes during our podcast talking about specifics. So Patrick Zimmerman is the predominant voice for Revolver, and I think he's the best of all of them. Mm-hmm. But Josh Keaton does young Revolver in Metal Gear Solid 3, and I thought he did a really good job. Mm-hmm. And then Troy Baker, who does everything, wow. takes mm-hmm. over yeah. for him in 5.
Okay.
And I think he did a good job there
yeah.
as well. So this is not a villain, but he's antagonistic. So I'm throwing him in because I forgot to mention him in the hero part. But Cranky Kong is great. Oh, yeah. Not just because of the endless harassment, but the part of his history that was the part that was retconned by Nintendo, which was that he's actually the original Donkey Kong. And the idea being that he got old, and then I think it's implied that Donkey himself is Donkey Kong Jr. grown up as well. Mm-hmm. But Nintendo did away with that, because the idea is the characters are immortal, they don't get older. But
yeah.
that original dynamic's really funny to think about, yes. that he's the original Donkey Kong, went through all this trouble with the old school graphics and everything, the more, you know, old fashioned way of playing.
Wait, I didn't realize that got retconned. What?
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal with Donkey Kong Jr. in current Nintendo continuity?
They just never show him.
Yeah, he's just off.
I think
doing
he actually
something.
Did they put him into tour?
If they no.
He hasn't become a player in tour?
No, so there's been Donkey. Oh, wait, hang on. Is it Donkey Kong Jr. in Mario Super Mario Kart?
Mm-hmm.
Then yes, he is.
That's the most recent appearance by him. Yeah. Otherwise, they've ignored him for like 30 years.
Because and even then, in Mario Kart Tour, you could get both Mario and Donkey Kong Jr. the exactly as they appear, the you know the pixelated characters. So even then, like they didn't like give him an updated character model like in modern graphics. It's just
Well, thank you. This is probably my yearly fill of Donkey Kong continuity trivia.
Yep, they got rid of that change. But he's a great character. He was better when Rare was writing him because he had that British snarkiness, you know? Like, they still try to make him sarcastic and everything now, but he was a little more brutal in the Super Nintendo games.
Makes you also wonder if he was a little jealous of Donkey Kong.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. It had to be, you know, with the shiny, beautiful graphics, and he's all old and decrepit. And then also not a villain, but I guess he'd be labeled an anti-hero. I like Travis Touchdown in No More Heroes. Mm-hmm. He's such a just like slime ball, but you like him anyway because he, especially in the first game. So they re-release these games for Switch. I have them on Wii, but I got them after the fact and never went back and, like, played them. So when they re-released the games for the Switch, I was like, okay, I'm going to try them finally. And, man, that first game is just so fun. It's super irreverent. And then Travis is just, like, completely the opposite of any Nintendo hero, you know? It's like he's unapologetic about just being rude and disgusting and... I'm forgetting the name of the... There's a female character in the game that he's just endlessly trying to get with. And it's problematic by today's standards, but it's still hilarious. Yeah, but anyway, he's cool, you know? Like, and it was interesting because when I was playing that game, something at the same time or round about that time brought Johnny Knoxville back into my attention. Because Jackass 4, you know, Forever or whatever is going to be coming out. And they're all kind of from the same era. You know, it's like when Jackass was sort of...
I would not be surprised if Johnny Knoxville was a visual inspiration for Travis Touchdown specifically.
Yep. And it's funny because I was I was reading the thing with Johnny Knoxville. And so I was like, I never really watched Jackass when I was, you know, younger. But I went and was like kind of looking at clips and stuff. And I'm looking at Knoxville and the guys and I'm like, these dudes were cool. Like, they're, like, punk cool.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, punk from, like, the 2000s, you know?
Yeah.
Like, with the cloth pants and then the belts and everything. And and then Travis totally has that vibe. And I'm like, Travis is cool, too. He's totally, like, a guy from that era.
But he's, like, a pathetic version of them. Like, he's deliberately pathetic.
He's, well, but that's the thing. It's like, he's pathetic, but then he goes and, like, he can slaughter countless people.
But
it's like,
he remains pathetic. Like, that's... This is, like, the thing. It's like, he's... Have you beaten this game?
I've beaten this game. Travis is cool.
Okay. All right. He can kill people with a beam saber or whatever it's
beam
called.
Beam katana.
Beam
Thank
katana.
You. Yes.
Yeah.
You wish you had one. I know.
But...
As do I.
He's, like... Like, the game is not subtle about calling him a loser.
He's a lovable loser.
Sure.
Just like
no,
Johnny
yeah.
Knoxville. I mean,
okay.
They're losers,
yeah, yeah.
too. Yeah, but it's like, but you still think they're cool anyway.
Yeah.
It's like, the dude's like... You know, the disgusting things they would do on that show.
Yeah.
It's like, but then you still like them.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. If I'm in a room with somebody who's telling me Travis Touchdown is super cool, I'm just like, am I on fucking crazy pills here? Like, what is going on?
Travis is cool. Man, especially the Derek Robertson art for No More Heroes 3. Man, he made him look super cool in those drawings. So yeah, I'm adding him in there.
I do have a Final Fantasy 14 villain that I want to... give credit to, but I can't really go into it because Angela is still in Stormblood.
Oh.
And I can't spoil, like, look, I gladly spoil things for all of our listeners, but
he's already spoiled enough Unintentionally, he'll be talking enthusiastically about something that's happened in Final Fantasy 14, and then he just lets something slip, and I'm like, I hadn't done that yet.
Basically, what Zach's getting at here is he can ruin your day. He can't ruin the wife's.
Yeah, yeah.
you gotta get through the game, baby.
I know, but you know, we haven't been able to play in like the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, you were dragging the house. Your feet even still. But yeah. Anyone who's ever, like, in the past couple of years seen a list of, like, best video game villains knows there's exactly one Final Fantasy XIV villain that's made it onto those lists. The Shock of White Hair. Not going to go into it, but I do want to.
Well, I mean, you'd probably say the name, right? It's fine.
Emmett Selk.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen him in some of what I've seen you play, you know, in the later expansions.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm familiar with the character. I just don't know, you know, any real specifics about him. But
yeah. You know, a lot of Final Fantasy villains can be slotted into different tropes. Emmett Selk is, in that sense, not an entirely original villain, but I do really like the way he's presented. I like his sarcasm, his, like, constant air of superiority, but also, like, a bit of woundedness. Like, he's sad because of he can't have the thing he's so desperate to restore. And I do like the kind of tragic relationship between Emmett Selk and his world and the world he's in. And look, I don't want to get too close to spoiling things, but he's really good
for me. I don't know if she'd necessarily count as an enemy or even an antagonist, but she's certainly not squarely in the realm of hero either, but her from Ruiner. Puppy, the guy that you play as,
yeah,
has I was actually disappointed because the outfit he's wearing, like the leather jacket with the like button up shirt button all the way to the top to the top button in the concept art, he doesn't look like that in the game. It's unfortunate because he looks so cool in that concept art. But I almost can't even call him a cipher. He looks really cool in the game, but he has no, you know, personality at all.
Mm-hmm.
Her is fascinating because she can be genuinely unnerving at times.
Isn't she an AI? Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly, or was it not clear?
No, I mean, she is a person.
Okay.
But she is not everything that she portrays herself to be. And she has these moments where she gets extra dark and pretty brutal. And, you know, the art that shows up in the top of the screen when she's talking to you or she's speaking, you know, she has these moments where she's like looking up in like this weirdo, creepy, evil kind of way. And she looks really unnerving and disturbing. But it's the way that she can go from like quirky and like kawaii, and, like very anime, and like, you know, supporting you know, like, you know, like go get him puppy and like that kind of stuff to being just like twisted and a little bit, not a little bit, but like very dark. And the fact that you really can't, even at the very end, you don't really know that you can totally trust her. She's super interesting. And so while she's not exactly an anime or an antagonist, she's definitely one of the best parts of that game.
How problematic is it that I don't have any women on my list of favorite heroes or villains?
None. Not at all.
Am I canceled?
No.
Okay.
Well, we can only hope.
I'm about done with my antagonist list. I have one more on my list, Delita from Final Fantasy Tactics, but he's honestly... I realize in talking about Kiryu Nishiki that in broad strokes, it's kind of a similar dynamic between him and... Anyhow, Final Fantasy Tactics has a great story, but I'm not gonna get into it. I'm about ready to move into like my odds and ends list, but I don't want to cut you off if either you have other villains you want to go over.
No, I think I've had more odds and ends than
proper entries myself anyway.
Okay.
No, I think I'm good.
So the ultimate odd end is Shy Guy. He's the greatest Nintendo character.
Did he just steal that? Were you going to say Shy Guy?
Well, Shy Guy is my very favorite Mario character, like of the Super Mario franchise. No question.
There is no character as adorable as Shy Guy. The mask, the body, the voice.
It's so interesting how, despite, you know, not talking, not, well, they do have some moments where they speak, especially in like Paper Mario. But like even that, like they're just these just bizarre. The Shy Guys are bizarre, but they're so funny. And they do these unexpected things. And like even like in the Origami King, the Shy Guy, I think he's called Laundry Guy. The Shy Guy who's sitting next to a washing machine and he's doing his laundry and he's reading a book. He's just so funny and he's just so cute. They're without question the very best of the Super Nintendo, of the Super Mario franchise. They're the best characters.
It almost makes sense to compare them not to Mario characters, but to like mooks.
Mooks.
In like across different, right? Like. Like, it almost makes sense to compare Shy Guy more to, like, Bokoblin than it does to compare Shy Guy to Toad. Yeah. They're kind of like the Mario universe equivalent of, like, what do they call the Serve Bots from Mega Man Legends? You know?
Where they're like minions.
Yeah, all-purpose comedy minions, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the Shy Guys. I mean, Soap and McTavish kind of fell into this a little bit. Because, I mean, like, as characters, I like them, but... For me, characters I'll fall in love with almost without needing a lot of provocation for it. Like I said, sometimes just visually, like, that's enough. Like, what's the name of the character that looks like Boba Fett in Mega Man X?
Oh, Vile. Yeah.
Like, Vile doesn't have much to him, but I think he's freaking cool. Mm-hmm. And, like, so he's up there. Meta Knight's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
He's a beloved character.
Wow, big old thumbs down from Zach over here.
I love the dynamic between him and Kirby, and it's funny too because it's like Kirby's just running around in his weird little shoes, and then you have Meta Knight, who's all over the top with the sword and the mask and the giant cape. It's like, how do they fit into the same world? And yet it works.
Mm-hmm. Totally works.
Yeah, the Kirby character dynamic with him and DDD and Meta Knight, like, I love how they're all like enemies, but not like more than probably anybody else in Nintendo's lineup.
What is up with Nintendo and like the big fat comic villain DDD, K. Rool, Bowser, who at I don't know if this is like somebody that lived across the street from Yamauchi that he was just insistent that they keep making fun of every time they came up with a new IP, but what is Nintendo's issue with the big fat comic villain?
Well, there's Ganon. He's not big fat in comic. Andross.
I didn't say there weren't exceptions.
Ridley.
I didn't say there weren't exceptions. But
well, I'm saying I think there's quite a few to go against this notion that there's so many.
But there are so many.
Well, there's three that we've named. Give us more.
That's a lot, dude.
That means I can't name any more.
That's a lot. And that's how Wario got his start, too. Like, they've turned him into a franchise. Like, maybe you can even count Donkey Kong is originating in this category also.
Kind of. Right? He's supposed to be Bluto.
It's weird.
I guess.
It's like, you just imagine, like, you know, there's stories about, like, Miyamoto going around to, like, people's desks and being like, hey, he changes one thing. I just imagine, like, every time he finds somebody working on a new game, he's like, have you tried making the villain big and fat and kind of foolish?
That's all I was going to say. He looks at it, just make him fat. Yeah. Wario is another one that deserves a mention. I love Wario. He's so bizarre. And then the evolution of him with the WarioWare franchise. Because he was, like, you know, you have the Wario games after Mario Land 2. But then you get to WarioWare, and it's an explosion of his own weirdo side cast of characters. And then his bizarre company that he runs with these knockoff Nintendo systems that he makes. Like, oh, he's great.
The weirdest.
His catchphrase, have a rotten day.
I can't believe I forgot. Sir Emmerich.
in Final Fantasy 14. Wow. Forgot him. Sorry. He probably would have gone under the, you know, heroes
side. The subheading of Blinks?
No.
Links and Clouds?
No. I think that he is a great character. I think his design is super cool. I think it's also, he can be a little frustrating at times because I think he's a little too idealistic and in an unrealistic way. But he has a great heart, and I'd definitely put him in the heroes category of characters I like.
Mm-hmm. I think Lucas in Mother 3 deserves a shout out. I have a Game Boy Advance cartridge of Mother 3 that has the fan translation patch on it. Mm-hmm. So it's just an English localized copy of Mother 3, and that's how I've played it.
You know how he transitioned immediately from I like this character to let me tell you about this object I have?
Don't forget Zach's anti-object.
I'm not twice anti-object.
Fixating. He heard object and had to try to kill it. Anyway, so that's how I've played Mother 3. And I've gotten, I think I'm maybe a quarter of the way through the game, close to half. And man, that's another one where like I can't just give him a full blown, you know, character nod like everyone else I've listed, because he's also a bit of like a cipher, doesn't talk. Mm-hmm. But the story in Mother 3 is really interesting, and it's like oddly dark and really engaging.
So what do you like about Lucas?
Oh, he's easy to root for. Because he's, like, gone through all this, and he's looking for his brother, and his dad's gone, and
Okay.
So, yeah, Lucas is cool. In fact, I've spent more time with Mother 3 than Earthbound at this point, so I almost think I might like him more than Ness.
Wait, have you not played much of Earthbound?
I have not beaten it.
Okay. All right. Well, if you get back to it, let me know what you think of it.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a couple of odds and ends characters to go over myself. One, I'm sure we can all agree on the merchant from Resident Evil 4.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
Not much to say about him other than the voice is absurd. The appearance is absurd. The idea of this merchant appearing everywhere on this island is absurd. The beautiful way the voice clips cut themselves off if you're rapidly going through his inventory.
Yep.
It's all great. There's one Final Fantasy support character I've always had a soft spot for, which is Rydia from Final Fantasy IV. She's a summoner. She's only like 6 years old when the game starts, but she's from the Village of Mist, where the residents there have the ability to summon monsters. And because of that, they're seen as a military threat. So the game kind of opens with the main character being essentially tricked into delivering a package to the Village of Mist that destroys the village. Rydia is the only survivor. And you end up having to save this girl whose mother you've killed. The whole village has like been destroyed because of your actions. And so Rydia hates you. Like she even though she can do black magic, she can't cast fire because she's so traumatized by her village being destroyed in flames. She's being forced to travel with this Dark Knight who is responsible for the destruction of everything she loved. And then she gets swallowed by a sea serpent. And there's a twist in that sea serpent is actually the Leviathan, the king of the summoned monsters, and takes her to this other basically pocket realm where time passes differently. Later in the game, after Cecil, the main character, kind of repents, rejects the dark arts, becomes a paladin. The villain's about to defeat him. And then Rydia, who is, because she's been in this pocket dimension, has like, relative to the rest of the world, she's aged up like 10 or so years, is now like on the cusp of adulthood, comes out of nowhere, beats back the villain. And I've always been kind of like, I know it's like a 16-bit Super Nintendo game. It's like not really that impressively told on screen just because of the technical limitations, but it like affected me the how completely Rydia was able to forgive Cecil and like swoop back in to like save him. That's an element of that game and her character arc that I really liked.
I really like Estinian in Final Fantasy 14, and I was watching Zach play some months ago, and I can't stand Alphino. I don't really like Alisei either, but I think Alfano's just an obnoxious little shit who's just so up his own ass and thinks he's fantastic, at least, you know, through all the game that I've played. And so, and he's annoying in part because he's an idealist to a fault. It's fine to want to make the world a better place, and obviously is a good thing, but he doesn't know his place. And like Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry once said, man's got to know his limitations, and Alfano doesn't know his. At least it's worse earlier in the game. I think he still has that problem moving forward. But basically, Stinian puts him in his place at one point, and it's just like, the world is not kind. You seem to think that you can just make the world, shape the world into this utopia of sunshine and unicorns and everybody's okay and everybody's friends and everybody gets along. That's not the way of the world. He's just like, you're an idealist, I'm a realist. And obviously it's not good to be too far on the opposite end of the spectrum either, but I really appreciate the way Estinian just doesn't, he's not interested in being this little Alfano. And like he comes to appreciate Alfano and likes him almost like a little brother, but I do appreciate his realism.
Alfano is definitely humbled by certain events in the game.
Mm-hmm.
I do think if you look at the whole game that Alfano's point of view is more vindicated than Estinian's point of view.
I mean, it makes sense. You know, it's a JRPG and there's a lot of idealists in this game and there's a lot of, you know, supporting head nods and yes, we're going to change the world. And so, yeah, I mean, I can understand Alfano being vindicated more than Estinian, but I'm much more of an Estinian myself.
I only have one more on my list. I think it's something Robert would back me up on, which is Missile, the dog from Ghost Trick.
Yes. Agreed.
He's just such a good boy. But like, not in the meme-y way people will refer to dogs in general, just for being cute. Like, what Missile goes through, like that... Angela, you haven't played Ghost Trick?
No, and I'm not going to, okay. So you can... It's fine.
Well, it's got, like... The plot is too convoluted to try and convey, but it's got this twist ending that does involve time travel and body hopping and all this stuff. Makes total sense in the context of the game, like totally bought it. But the revelation that, this is going to sound ridiculous to say, that a lamp that you met at the beginning of the game, a talking lamp named Ray, was actually like the spirit of this dead Pomeranian sent back in time that has dedicated 10 years of its afterlife to being able to resurrect its owner, to prevent its owner's death in like this time loop. And that so much of the game's events were driven by this little dog's will to save his owner. I got real misty at the end of Ghost Trick.
Yes, Ghost Trick's great. You know, it's been so long since I played Ghost Trick. I should try replaying it because I remember getting to the end and thinking, man, once you play this game, you know how the twist works and you'll never not be able to know how the twist works. I remember enough of it that the character's name is Cecil, right?
Sissel,
but Sissel's the cat.
Yeah.
And man, it's funny because it's like you'll never... you'll never forget that. You'll never unlearn that bit of the story. And like, to me, that diminishes a little bit if you try to go replay it. But it's been so long that that's the only part of the game I can remember super firmly. So it'd be worth replaying because that game has such amazing animations.
It's so good. Like, yeah, it's like this weird, it's kind of got like a rotoscoped animation feel to it. I don't know if it actually is, but... Or if they, you know, use that in producing it. But yeah, like the weird low-res 3D models that have such smooth and like charismatic movement. It's really cool.
Yep.
The portraits are really good too. Like the whole package is really cool to look at, despite being, you know, obviously a pretty low-resolution DS game.
There's a mobile version I have downloaded on my phone that I've never actually opened, but... Part of me refuses to play it because I'm just like, it's supposed to be the kind of grainy DS graphics. That's what made it so neat.
I think as it is, it's the best looking DS game.
I can see that argument. It was pretty incredible. That's another one of those Capcom titles that didn't hardly sell anything, so you'll never see another one of them. Trying to think of other honorable mentions. I mean, Captain Falcon, of course. Show me your moves. I love Beautiful Joe. He's so annoying and zany. That's a great character. They need to do another one of those. Anyone else we want to add in?
I think my last...
All right, Angie's going to close this out.
Yeah. You know, I could mention a lot of people, like Vincent Valentine, I think is awesome. But I'll close off with Snake and Kid Kat from Animal Crossing. Specifically, especially from Animal Crossing New Horizons. Because they're both, like, Snake is, he takes himself seriously as, like, I'm a serious ninja. And then Kid Kat is supposed to be like a Power Ranger. What's the Japanese word for that?
Sentai. Snake is a bunny rabbit in Naruto cosplay.
Yeah. So Snake is he's a pink bunny. I think everyone kind of understands the gist of Animal Crossing, but there's a bunch of different types of animals, cats, dogs, rabbits, etc. And Snake is one of the rabbits, but he's got big pink ears. His face, he's almost like a Sanrio character, which I think is really funny. But he's dressed in this blue ninja costume. And then Kid Kat, there's like four, I think, or whatever, different animals that are in these super...
Sentai, like ranger
outfits. Yeah, Sentai outfits. Ranger outfits.
Yeah.
And so Kid Kat's red and he's wearing this little helmet and he's this little white cat. But they both take themselves very seriously as, you know, a Power Ranger-ish character or a ninja. But they're goofy. And they're not... I don't know if they're supposed to be... Like, I don't know if Snake's supposed to be a successful ninja. Or if Kid Kat was supposed to have actually saved people. But they're so comical and so bizarre. And they're both... Because, you know, Animal Crossing characters have different personalities. There's, like, jocks and grumpy and, like cutesy, supportive, whatever. But they're both the jock characters.
Yeah.
So they're obsessed with... They're narcissistic. They're obsessed with themselves, obsessed with their muscles. That's all they really want to talk about. They're incredibly one-dimensional in terms of their thinking and obsessions.
Yeah, the extent of Snake's ninja training... is like free weights and squats.
Yeah. Yes. And it's funny when your neighbors interact with each other and when you listen in on their conversations, because both Snake and Kid Kat, they're like not very bright, but they're incredibly kind and very well-meaning. But it's also funny how they consider you rivals, like athletic rivals, even though you're just the human character on the island. You're not buff. You can't work out. Like, the closest thing you could do is wear workout clothing and then, like, do some, like, yoga poses.
Realistically, you've got to have some pretty defined back muscles after all that shoveling.
And cutting down trees. But it's just funny how they just instantly hone in on you as their rival. They call you your rival. And they're just so goofy and bizarre. And I love them. They're my two favorite neighbors in Animal Crossing.
Three cheers for the jock.
Yes.
All right. You've been listening to how many minutes?
It was a lot of minutes this time.
7 minutes.
Well, yeah, technically. But yeah.